All right, you can open your Bibles to 1 Kings 18. If it's your first time, just so that you know what we're doing here, we're kind of going to spend some time digging into the Bible. And as a matter of fact, this is a great moment to be here because we are starting a brand new little series that's going to take us about 8 weeks. About 8 weeks. We're calling it One Voice. One Voice. Because life is full of voices, isn't it? Have you ever been someplace and it was really hard to hear somebody because there was so much going on? You know, there's so many things talking. You know, this happened to me just the other night, just maybe 2 weeks ago. I was at a roller skating thing with my two kids. It was me and my two kids. My wife was doing something else at the time. And so me and my two kids at a roller skating rink. How many of you have been to a roller skating rink? How many of you, it's been a long time? Well, I want to let you know, nothing has changed at all. Literally, the roller skates I put on my feet had been there for decades. If you can picture the neon paint job with the planets and stuff that every single roller skating rink I have been in three different states all had, it's still there, guys. Don't worry. Not one thing. It is possible that actual slice of pizza I bought had been cooked in 1972. I'm not sure. But it's exactly the same. So me and my kids go on this kind of school event thing to the roller skating rink over on Route 1, and we're roller skating, and nothing is funnier than being the one parent of two children who go at radically different speeds, neither of whom know how to roller skate. And so they both desperately want my help. One of them wants my help zipping, and the other one wants my help carefully going. And if you know my children, you know which one's which. But, you know, and so I'm kind of trading back and forth with them. Like, you know, I'll spend like 10 or 15 minutes with one kid, and then I'll kind of roller skate around to get to the other kid, and then I'll spend some time with that kid, and then I'll roller skate around. And so I'm just kind of bouncing back and forth between the two kids because really was a good chance for us to hang out, and I was really, really having a good time or whatever. And so, but the complicated thing is that a roller skating rink is a very hard place to get someone's attention because there's like crazy music, which by the way was the same music, if I didn't mention that already. You know, it was like Ice Ice Baby. You know, it was good. And so, you know, nothing had changed, but so I would see my son, who's 9, kind of around the curve in front of me, and he's like, you know, doing this sort of thing, you know, where he's like trying to roller skate and it's not working at all. And so, you know, but he's trying, and but by the time and I'll be honest, it has been a while since I've been on roller skates, and so for me to get to him took a little bit of focus, or I was going to be the one falling. And so I would get to him, but of course when I get to him, he's not there anymore. He's moved on because he's on roller skates. And so so I'm trying to call him the whole time. I'm like, hey, Wesley. And of course, he could be 3 feet in front of me. And with the like, thump, 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 thump. And all of the big kids, I'm back into a place in life where there are big kids again. You know, and so with all the big kids zipping past us, and me trying to get to my kid, like, he cannot hear a word. But I would finally get to him. And literally, of course, as soon as I get to him, he would trip and fall, and I would zip past him, and he would not see me. Right? And so, and this happened with both the kids all night, just over and over again, trying to get to them, but they can't hear a word that I'm saying. And this is life, right? Sometimes all the voices drown out the one voice that really matters. And so tonight, and for the next about 2 months, we're going to be looking at learning how to hear that one voice that really matters. And we're going to use as our model a group of men from the Old Testament called the prophets. Now, some of you who've been around for a while may have noticed that there is a theme to the way that I have been working through Wednesday nights over the last couple of years. If you haven't been around long enough to notice this, it doesn't matter. We're kind of starting at a fresh place. But for those of you who have been around for a while, We have been working our way through the Old Testament, bit of the story by bit of the story by bit of the story. The Bible is broken up into these two big chunks around two big agreements that God made with mankind. And so, because there's two of them, we call one the Old and one the Old Testament, the New Testament. The New Testament is the agreement God made with mankind around Jesus, and the previous agreement was the agreement God made with mankind really around the nation of Israel. And so there's this beautiful story that the Bible tells of what happens throughout history from the creation of the world up until Jesus. And we've been tracing that story together. And so for those of you who haven't been around for a little while, I just want to make sure you know where we're at in the story so that we can pick up at the right point. So here is the story so far. God makes the world, and he makes it good, and he makes it beautiful. But it's very wild. And so in the middle of a very wild creation, he creates this one place that is orderly. It's a garden. He places mankind in that garden. He says, hey, your job, humanity, is to go out into the world and bring order out of the chaos. The word he uses is to subdue the earth. And so mankind is supposed to do that. And so unfortunately, mankind rebels against God's authority, disobeys, rejects his leadership. And rather than bringing order out of the chaos, humanity adds to the chaos of the world. And so the world gets worse instead of better. God at this point could have given up on the whole creation story. He could have just blackballed the thing and started over. But he decided he wouldn't. He loved creation and he loved mankind so much that he was committed to doing whatever it took to restore the world to the plan he had originally created it for. And so he promises that through humanity, he is going to restore the world. But over the generations that come, the world gets worse and man gets worse. It takes one generation for murder to enter into the world, and it gets worse and worse from there. And it looks like there is no hope until God chooses this one man named Abraham, and he says, I am going to restore the world through you and your descendants throughout the upcoming many, many generations. And that man, Abraham, is the beginning of the Jewish nation. And so God is going to use the Jewish nation to restore the world. But things do not go well for Abraham and his descendants. Not at the beginning, anyway. At the very beginning, Abraham lives and dies well, but then his great-grandkids end up being enslaved in a land far from where they had originally heard God's voice. And so there they are, enslaved in that far-off land, thinking that they have this amazing destiny, but looking at their everyday reality, thinking, this doesn't look like the destiny I thought God promised me. And so they start to cry out to God, God, come and restore us. Come and rescue us. Come and free us. And so in that moment, God raises up a man to lead them, a man named Moses. And Moses brings them out of slavery under God's leadership, brings them through this horrific trek, and throughout about a generation, they are given a special land that is going to be God's gift to them. It's their inheritance as God's people. And their job is to live in that land and demonstrate what it looks like to be God's people. Because surely, if somebody would just act like God's people, everybody would turn and say, wow, that looks amazing. We want to be like them and come and find out what they need to do. They were supposed to be sort of a living advertisement for God's leadership in the world. But, like all of us, when they commit themselves, when the Jewish nation committed itself to following God's leadership, like all of us, they had an up and down success rate. Anybody ever feel like that is your spiritual journey? An up and down success rate? You know, this is their story. And so they, a lot of times, don't look any different from any other nation. But so God eventually appoints a king, and we talked about that king. His name was David, and David is a really amazing king, but a very broken king. And he makes some poor decisions that impact eventually the character of his son. His son lives out the same character defects that his father had. Anybody ever felt like this was part of their life story too? See character defects going from generation to generation. His son lives out the same character defects, but on a grander scale, and he passes those character defects on to his son, and eventually what happens, there is a giant civil war, and the country turns into two nations, a northern nation and a southern nation. And neither one of them is particularly faithful to God's call. The southern one is called Judah, and it's a little bit more faithful to God, but not much. The northern one is called Israel, and it is consistently, unbelievably unfaithful. So for several hundred years, about 300 or 400 years, this is the state of affairs. The political leadership is up and down and up and down, and the people's faithfulness is up and down and up and down. And it looks like the whole system is going to fall apart. And one of the amazing things that happens is that God never gives up on his people. He never gives up. And so over and over and over again in this moment when the leadership is looking bad and the people look like they've walked out on God and everybody's kind of apathetic to their spiritual journey and whatever's going on, God never gives up, and he sends messengers that we call prophets, who are his spokespeople. They aren't fortune tellers. We talked about this a little bit in the New Testament last week or the week 2 weeks ago. And when the Old Testament and the New Testament use the word prophet, they really kind of mean something different. In the Old Testament, you need to think of like a royal messenger. You know, if a king was going to inform a group of far-off people what was going on with him, the king would not get off his throne and go make the trip and do the informing. The king would give his message to a special envoy, and that envoy or diplomat or whatever would make the giant trek, and he would stand as the king's representative before whatever foreign power he's supposed to be talking to, and his job would be to say, this is what the king has to say to you. Well, that's really what prophets were. They heard directly from God and were given messages that they were to deliver throughout the generation. So we're going to look throughout this series. We're going to take each week, we're going to look at a different prophet. Tonight, we're going to look at Elijah. Elijah was one of the great prophets in the Old Testament, and he lived in one of the darkest moments in Israel's history up until Jesus' day. It was so bad. His king, well, here, we'll actually read this. I want to start off by reading just a little bit. So open your Bibles, 1 Kings. 1 Kings. So I want you to start in 1 Kings 16, verse 29. We're going to introduce ourselves to Ahab. Ahab is the king when Elijah comes on the scene. 1 Kings 16, verse 29 says this. It says, Ahab, son of Omri, he was the previous king, began to rule over Israel, that's that northern kingdom I was talking about, in the 38th year of King Asa's reign in Judah. So Asa's reigning in the southern king, Ahab is reigning in the northern kingdom. But Ahab, son of Omri, did what was evil in the Lord's sight, even more than any of the kings before him. And as though it were not enough to follow the sinful example of Jeroboam, that was the first king who caused the civil war that I talked about, he married Jezebel, the daughter of King Ethbaal of the Sidonians, and he began to bow down and worship of Baal. And on it goes. So the idea here is, first of all, he's doing the same kinds of evil everybody else before him did. Second, he then lets himself be influenced by a woman who is not trying to go in the same direction he's trying to go. He's supposed to be trying to follow God. He marries this woman who's going in a completely different direction, and it turns out she happens to be a woman of literally no character. She makes it her life mission to destroy any of God's people she can find. She is an evil woman. Her name is Jezebel. And so this is the situation that Elijah finds himself in, and God speaks in a host of ways throughout Elijah. At one point, he sends a drought. He says, no, Because one of the things we often forget, we think of rain as something that comes to us just because there happen to be clouds with enough humidity. You know, I was downstairs in the basement, you know, the building flooded through over the weekend, and so I was downstairs in the basement earlier today, and I was changing the buckets. We are pulling about a gallon of water out of the air in the basement every hour. There is that much humidity in the basement right now of this building that we're in. And what's amazing to me about that is I keep expecting it to form its own weather patterns down there. I'm waiting for clouds and rain to happen in the basement. We've got fans moving it around, so I just assume at some point it's just going to start raining. But, you know, and that's really what we think about. When we think of rain, we think of this sort of natural process that is a result of evaporation and humidity and cold fronts and warm fronts and whatever else it is. We don't all know exactly what's going on up there, but we're pretty sure it's a process. One of the things God is taking a moment in this moment in history that we're going to read about to remind his people of is that everything, even things that seem natural like rain, are under God's authority. And so he says, here's what's going to happen. You are rejecting my leadership, so I'm going to take my hands off of you. I'm going to let you do things your way, and I'm going to pull away some of the blessings you forgot I was constantly giving you, just to see, let you see what it's like to be on your own. And he says one of those things is the rain. And so it's not going to rain anymore. And so for years, it just stops raining. And this is the moment we walk into the story. God took care of the prophet Elijah during this whole giant drought, but the whole country is suffering under a drought. And then we pick up the story in 1 Kings chapter 18. And I want you to listen to this. The theme we're going to be listening for whenever we read is for what is said. We're listening for a voice in every verse that we read. And so here's what it says. It says in 1 Kings 18 verse 1, it says, later on in the third year of the drought, the Lord said to Elijah, go and present yourself to King Ahab. Tell him that I will soon send rain. So Elijah went to appear before Ahab. Now I scoured these chapters, the next couple of verses, to find out what else God said to Elijah. And the answer is nothing. God said that one sentence to Elijah. It doesn't seem like that much, right? Go tell the king this thing. It's not like, so he goes, supposed to go to the king. He says what he's supposed to say to the king, and then he's done with his job, right? Except he goes out on a giant limb because of this word from God. His response to this simple word from God is to go to the king. He says to the king, why don't you gather the whole country together? Because we need to have a little chat. And so he gathers all the leadership of the entire country, including the religious leaders who were opposed to God's leadership in the country. Just get everybody. Get everybody. And then when they all gather on this one mount, Mount Carmel, and so not like caramel, but that is what I think about every time because I like. But anyway, so they gather on Mount Not Caramel, and there they are on the top of the mountain. And then Elijah decides, no, hold on, I'm not delivering the message yet because I want to make sure you understand who you're listening to. Not me, but God. I want you to understand how significantly important God is. So let's just, you know, and this is what would happen. If a messenger were delivering a message for a king, his first job would be to establish the authority of the king. Does that make sense? Let me make sure you understand I'm telling you something from someone who has a right to give you a command. And so here's what he does. He says, all right, we're going to have a little contest. There's, I don't remember if it's 200 or 400 prophets of the false god Baal. And then on God's side, there's just him. So it's 400 to 1. He says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get two cows, and you can have one and I can have one. Pick whichever one you want. And they pick one. He says, all right, so we're going to prepare a sacrifice. They used to sacrifice animals to the gods back then. Even our God wanted this to be done at the time. And so what they would do is they would build a giant pile of rocks, and they would slaughter the animal on top of the rocks, and then they would light the animal on fire to burn it up. And that was the way that, in theory, the smoke of it would ascend up to God. And so Elijah says, all right, so here's what we'll do. You go ahead and set up your altar. I'll set up my altar. You put the wood on your altar. I'll put the wood on my altar. You put the cow on your altar. I'll put the cow on my altar. You slaughter your cow. I'll slaughter my cow, but then we're going to stop. And then we're just going to pray. And we're going to ask our mutual gods to send fire down onto the altar. And we're just going to see who's in charge. So why don't you go first? And so he just steps back and he lets him go. So 400 prophets of this god Baal, they gather around this altar and they're dancing and shouting and screaming. And at some point, my favorite thing about this story is that there's sarcasm in it. It's wonderful. And so Elijah is watching them and they get all worked up into a frenzy and get all like crazy about it. And they're like cutting themselves and shouting and screaming and dancing and just going after it. And he says, hey, you know, you might want to call a little louder. I bet he's just napping. Maybe he's just not home. Just a little bit louder. Keep going. So if they keep going and they keep going and they keep going, nothing happens. Of course nothing happens. Eventually they wear themselves out and it's Elijah's turn. He says, I don't know about this. This doesn't look very hard. So he calls for vats of water to be poured all over his offering. Just vats and vats of water to soak it all down. You ever tried to light a fire with wet wood? Anybody try to do this? This is awful. I have done this. It is not fun. So he just soaks the wood, soaks the offering, soaks the stone, soaks it all. And they had danced and sung and shouted and screamed and everything they could think of. And he stands there. And in chapter 18, verse 36, this is what happens. Chapter 18, verse 36. At the usual time for offering the evening sacrifice, because they offered sacrifices every day at the same basic time, Elijah the prophet walked up to the altar and prayed, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, prove today that you are God in Israel and I am your servant. Prove that I have done all this at your command. O Lord, answer me, and answer me that these people will know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have brought them back to yourself. Immediately, the fire of the Lord flashed down from heaven, burned up the young bull. Sorry, I said it was a cow, it was a bull. Burned up the young bull, the wood, the stones, and the dust. It even licked up all the way. Oh, by the way, he poured so much water on this that he had to dig a giant trench around it so that the water could get collected. And it not only burned up the offering and the wood and the stones, it evaporated all of the water in the trench all the way around it. It was just gone. This is God's way of saying, yep, I'm here. Now you can give your announcement. Right? So he says, okay, it's now. At this point, everybody's listening, right? So he says, it's going to rain. He announces to the Lord, hey, it's going to rain. And on it goes the story. But the thing that I think is fascinating, he goes through all of that rigmarole based on one sentence that hey, just go let him know it's going to rain. That is all God had to say. And instead of making it easy for himself, Elijah, goes all out to risk everything. Not just his reputation, by the way. We think of risking everything as if, man, what if they get mad at me? That is not risking everything. That is risking next to nothing. Elijah's risk was not, what if they get mad at me? It was, oh, that's right, they've slaughtered all the other prophets. So if I show my face and I fail, they'll probably kill me. He was literally risking his life. And not only that, he was doing it in giant public ways. And not only that, but he was doing it he even let them go first. If they had somehow managed to pull that off, it would have been the end of contest. He wouldn't have gotten a turn. Right? At every step along the way, he is risking profoundly because the voice of God called him to do something. And the simplicity of what God said to do inspired him to take great risks. I'll tell you what I mean by that in a second. But then the story doesn't end there. Just a few verses later, 1 Kings, we were in Corinthians there for a little while. 1 1 Kings 19:2, it says this. 1 Kings 19:2 says this. It says, so Jezebel, that's the evil queen. Anybody make that da-da-da-da-da-da music for me? So Jezebel, the evil queen, we're not even going to try again. So Jezebel sent this message to Elijah, may the gods strike me and even kill me if by this time tomorrow I have not killed you just as you killed them. Oh, by the way, he ended the contest by slaughtering all the prophets so that they could not speak ill of God ever again. And so that was that. But so she says, here's the thing. You killed the prophet. I'm going to kill you. So he takes off and he runs for it. This is amazing to me. This man who heard, have you ever wished you could hear clearly from God, like actual words, because it would solve all of your problems? He hears clearly from God. He is so confident about this that he is willing to put all his eggs in that one basket and go all out in doing this very creative, very large, very public spectacle of an act of obedience. And when it is all done, and he has gotten to the end of God's command, he is still able to be scared by the other voices that he hears. Still able to be scared. And so I want to think about this over the next couple of weeks. I want to think about this, and there's a couple of things I want to draw out, and we're not going to end this conversation tonight. We're just going to start the conversation tonight. And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to dig in a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper and a little deeper. But tonight, I just want to notice three things off the bat that I think are very, very important for us to know about hearing from God. Number one, I want you to notice the difference between words and signs. Words and signs. We are a people who often are looking for a sign. You know, if you're asking God to raise you up, and you see an eagle flying by, that is clearly a sign from God. If you're asking God for a red car and a brand new Corvette rolls by, that is clearly a sign. That you should buy it for your pastor. You know, seriously though, but how many times have you heard this? Somebody says, I was looking for a job, and I was looking for a job, and I was looking for a job, and I prayed about the job, and then all of a sudden there was somebody mentioned a job. It was a sign, like God clearly wants me to take that job. You know, we hear about jobs like every day. That's not a sign. That's just a thing that happens whenever you talk to more than like four people at a time, because everybody has one or is looking for one. Right? Like we are searching the world to looking for subtle clues, as if God's way of communicating to us is going to be these subtle, hard to interpret clues that we might miss if we're not careful. Right? The problem is that this does not match the character of God. There's this fancy, you ready for a fancy theology word? I'll throw these out every once in a while just to prove to you that I know something. This fancy theology, here's what it is. The word is perspicacity. Everybody say perspicacity, 1, 2, 3. Perspicacity, it means knowable. The idea that God, the perspicacity of God means that God wants to be known. He wants to be understood. He is not looking to communicate to you in order to annoy you. He's not looking to communicate to you in a way that confuses you. He is never looking to communicate to you in a way that makes it hard to follow his directions. Let's be honest, following God's directions is hard enough if we understand them clearly, right? And God is okay with the directions being hard to follow in that way, but he does not want them to be hard to figure out. You know, if I have two kids, I had to study a bunch of languages for my last degree. And if I have two kids, my kids know English and like four words of Spanish. If I start giving them directions in Greek and then punish them for not getting it, whose fault is that? That makes me a bad father, right? And yet that is not far from what we think God is doing all the time. We think he's like weaving these subtle messages into the world that if only we just, like, it's like it's the whole world a giant magic eye, right? Like if I just stare at it long enough and like unfocus my eyes just a little and squint and kind of close one eye, he wants me to go left. Right? Like, this doesn't make any, like, if this is the best God can do, he is not as powerful as I think he is. And if you look at the Bible, and this is important, if you look at the Bible, over and over again, God communicates to his people, but it is always breathtakingly clear. Always. The prophets often will use this phrase, the Lord said. God uses words all the time. Sometimes we'll see in the Bible that God uses dreams and visions, and all of that is amazingly clear. Amazingly clear. You know, there are maybe three or four times I have clearly heard, like, the audible voice of, not audible, nobody else would have heard it, but I have clearly been in a moment where I thought, this is definitely God speaking to me. Not like every day of my life. Every one of those times, it was clear words. I knew what I was supposed to do. I'm one of them, the first time I ever felt like I really heard God. I know for sure that it was clear. Whatever it was clear, because it was clear enough that I argued. That is evidence of clarity right there. When you can argue, you know what you're supposed to do, right? I argued a lot. But, you know, clarity, this is a really big deal. God communicates clearly. As we start exploring what it means to hear the voice of God in our lives, we are going to start with this working assumption: God wants to be understood. So that's the first thing. The second thing are really just two practical things I want you to notice about Elijah's experience. The first one is, and we've hit these a little bit already, the first one is that a simple word from God allows for simple confidence. The fact that God was so clear in what he said to Elijah, there wasn't any wondering on Elijah. Elijah wasn't like, oh, I don't know. Man, maybe this is just me. Maybe there are always frogs hopping at this time of day. Right? Like he wasn't interpreting signs. He knew clearly God said, go tell the king now. By the way, this is a freebie, but I want to just throw this in there. I think that the word now is implicit in a lot of what God says. Just saying. It's not like, you know, Elijah would not have been following God's commands if he waited 16 years and then delivered the message. The now was supposed to be part of the, like, obviously what God was saying. But think about that. That's for somebody there. But simple word from God allows simple confidence. He could be confident enough to gather all of his enemies, the political enemies, the religious enemies, to have this giant contest, to do all this complicated stuff, because he was 100% certain that he had heard the voice of God. God's clarity can give us confidence. God's clarity can give us confidence. The other thing I want you to notice is that sometimes that confidence, let's put it this way, that confidence doesn't banish fear or doubt forever. God's clear word to us can give us great confidence that inspires us to heights of obedience we never dreamed possible in our lives, but we are still human. And while God is consistent and faithful all of the time, sometimes we are not. God is always going to speak, whatever. But it's a very real thing that sometimes when people have heard the voice of God in the past, there comes a moment where they start listening to other voices. And so we can't ever rest on the fact that we have experienced God, or we have heard God, or that we have understood in the past. You don't get to rest on your past experiences. The idea is to be continually pursuing the one voice that matters now. Listening for all the other voices that don't matter and just pushing them aside. Not thinking, you know what, well, I know I was hearing God then. That's not good enough. Are you trying to hear the voice of God now? Are you listening for the voice of God in this moment? Are you seeking to be obedient to the voice of God here and now, in this second, in this opportunity, in this experience that you're in right now? We can't ever rest on the past. Because there are always thousands upon thousands upon thousands of voices that are looking to invade your mind, heart, ears, thoughts, spirit. Every moment of the day, they're everywhere. So here's what we're going to do. For those of you who this is your first time on a Wednesday night, I'm going to talk for a little while, then we're going to break up into some discussion groups. If this is your first time, I'd encourage you to just come up once. In just a moment, we're going to break up into our groups. If you don't know what group to go to, just come up and ask me. I'm happy to direct you, more than willing to do that. But I want to remind everybody, can we get the rules on the screen? I want to remind everybody these rules real quickly as we begin a new series. Number one, keep it short. So, in every group, there is a long talker. And I know I've said this before, but if you don't know who the long talker is in your group, it's you. It's funny, I didn't even have to finish the sentence, did I? Y'all know it's true. But here's the thing. There are 6, 8, 10 people in this discussion with you. You want to give everybody a chance to answer the question. So make sure that you think through your answer enough to keep it short. Number two, keep it personal. You are only talking about you, nobody else. So if somebody shares something that's going on in their life, never, ever, ever in these groups does anybody say, you know what you should do? You know what you could do next? You know where you ought to? You know, no. You talk about you, they'll talk about them. Everybody will be happy that way. It's just a really good spiritual discipline to remind ourselves that we aren't God. We don't need to fix anybody. So keep it short, keep it personal, and keep it relevant. Many of us walk in here, and I am famous for doing this. I love to tell stories. I really do. And so if you are ever here during the day, there is a 50-50 shot that I will walk up to you and just start telling you a funny story, because I like stories a lot. And so I understand the burning urge to tell a funny story or a heartfelt story, and I understand the way a storyteller's brain works, that you are desperately searching for the shortest distance between the question and your story, whether it really works or not. God is calling you to practice the spiritual discipline of silence. So keep it short, keep it personal, keep it relevant. The idea here is to create a safe place for you to be able to share things that are significant to you, that are heartfelt to you, that are important to you. And the way that we have found to make sure that we all can do that for one another is to follow these rules. So help me out with that.